The X Zone radio and TV show is largely an opinion talk show. All opinions, comments, or statements of fact expressed by Rob McConnell's guests are strictly their own and are not to be construed as those of the X Zone radio and TV show or in any manner endorsed by Rob McConnell, Relmar McConnell Media Company, Talkstar Radio Network, its affiliated stations, or employees.
Welcome to the X Zone, a place where fact is fiction and fiction is reality. Now, here's your host, Rob McConnell.
Welcome back to the X-Zone. My name is Rob McConnell. We're coming to you live and around the world on the Talkstar Radio Network and our fine family of broadcast affiliates across Canada, the United States, Central America, the Caribbean, South America, the Pacific Rim, and now in 20 Asian countries. If you'd like to give us a call, 1-877-528-8255 is our studio number. On MSN Messenger, you can send a message to me here in our studio at talkstarradio@hotmail.com. My email address is xzone@talkstarradio.com and our website, www.xzoneradio.com. My guest this hour is John Stanley, and never before has a TV horror host described in print what it was like to be part of the cult movement of the 20th century, in which packages of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movies were introduced by colorful characters who often emulated supernatural beings. Now, these media entities, garbed as vampires, werewolves, ghouls, and other grotesque queries inspired by the cinema, as well as the espoused graveyard humor in a spoofery on the very movie material being presented. Generations grew up on these new fanged beans, and thousands of young viewers were shaped and changed forever by the humor and tomfoolery of hosts who came into their living rooms and or bedrooms on Saturday night, often after the witching hour. Joining us now is John Stanley. And John, how are you this evening?
Rob, I know you're associated with a TV show, Creepy Canada, so let me welcome you to Creepy California, especially the San Francisco Bay Area, where Creature Features, the show I hosted, was on the air for 14 years.
Wow.
No accounting for taste, is there?
Listen, it's still, people love to be scared. People love horror movies. People love science fiction. People love supernatural films for some reason, and I don't know.
And the reason, at least it's my take on it, Rob, the reason that generations that grew up watching that still fondly remember it, mm-hmm. and I have seen this at various conventions when I go back and I'm sharing a table with Bob Wilkins, another host from the Bay Area, the old fans come up to us and tell us different stories, and yet the stories are all the same. It's a nostalgic memory about growing up with family, mom and dad, brother and sister, whatever the combinations. Saturday night at home, it was a family thing, and it's still very fondly remembered. And at the heart of all of these programs were not only the old movies, good or bad, but those unusual hosts, those so-called horror hosts.
Yeah. You know what? You have had so many many guests over the years. You've interviewed the Omen producer Henry Bernhard. You've interviewed Ed and Lorraine Warren, Ray Bradbury, and my goodness,
yeah.
What was
but
it?
Rob,
what?
In addition to being a horror host during the 70s and early 80s, I was simultaneously a writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, mm-hmm. entertainment writer. So I had the opportunity over a 33-year period to meet some of the greatest people in showbiz, not just the horror and sci-fi icons of the past century, but just some of the really wonderful stars. And along the way, yeah, as you point out, I met those weird folks. I visited haunted houses. John Newland, the producer of One Step Beyond, told me about taking this new form of drug called LSD long before the coming of the Flower Children or the hippie generation. How about the slaughterhouse in Oakland, alleged to be the most haunted house in the San Francisco Bay Area? And some weird things went on there.
Well, why don't we talk about those weird things when we come back from this two-minute commercial break?
Okay.
John Stanley's our very special guest, and we're talking about I Was a TV Horror Host. His website is www.stanleybooks.net. And John and I will be back on the other side of this two-minute break as the X-Zone continues, live and around the world from our studios in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Once again, our toll-free number is 1-877-528-8255. Still to come tonight, T.K.C. Brennan and Cal Korf and Henry May. We'll be back on the other side of this break. Don't go away. John Stanley is our special guest. His website is www.stanleybooks.net. John, tell us about the interview you did with the Omen producer, Henry Bernhard. And apparently there were something strange with lightning that happened.
This was several years after the film came out in 1976. He came on our show. I think it was sometime in the early 80s. He continued to make horror films after the great success of The Omen. And he was promoting one of his lesser pictures. But he started telling me about this unusual coincidence where on three occasions a bolt of lightning came out of nowhere and was somehow related to people who were making the film. I believe it started with Gregory Peck. He was in a commercial jetliner on his way to Rome, and a bolt of lightning actually struck the aircraft. And Gregory Peck would tell the story that the one thing he would always remember, one of the stewardesses was down on her hands and knees in the middle of the plane, you know, praying and hoping that they were going to survive that bolt of lightning.
Boy, that gives you a lot of confidence, doesn't it?
Yeah. Then at the Hotel Flora Grande, he said he was fast asleep at 3 o'clock in the night, and suddenly there was this tremendous explosion outside his window. The entire sky lit up. It was like, he said, it was like watching an atomic bomb. The end of the world had come. And 30 feet away from where he was staying, a bolt of lightning had come down and struck one of the walls there. I think it was called Hadrian's Gate. They were shooting in London's Safari Park. And remember the sequence where Lee Remick's car is attacked by a gang of baboons?
Yes.
Well, the very next day, baboon trainer was attacked and killed and crushed to death in the very same location where the scene had been filmed.
You know, that almost parallels the paranormal disasters that went along with the filming of Poltergeist.
The Gee, I'm not familiar with that one. That's the Steven Spielberg film?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not in on that one. I've never met Steven Spielberg. Never had the opportunity. But again, it's it is a strange coincidence. In fact, there was also a moment where Gregory Peck was at an oyster bar in London, mm-hmm. and a terrorist bomb exploded seconds after he had walked out of the building. So there were all kinds of things that seemed to haunt the production of this one particular film. And I guess you could shrug and call it coincidence. I don't know.
No, I wouldn't call it coincidence. I would call it divine intervention.
It does make you wonder.
It certainly,
Rob, it really does.
It certainly does. What was it like interviewing Ed and Lorraine Warren, the demonologists?
Well, that's a great question. I'm glad you asked, because it's a moment my wife and I will never forget. We had gone to a wine cellar, Orsi's Restaurant, in the financial district of San Francisco, mm-hmm. and they were on the road. They were taking this very matter-of-factly, promoting not the first Amityville film, but the second, the Amityville 2, The Possession.
Mm-hmm.
This was 1982, and because we wanted a little privacy, the maitre d' decided to put us down in their wine cellar, where, you know, there were... Ed and Lorraine, my wife and I, and a couple of publicists from the company that was releasing the film. And suddenly my wife, Erica, who has had some unusual psychic experiences off and on during her life, again, inexplicable, suddenly grabbed me by the arm and said, "Honey, there's something standing in the doorway behind us." And, of course, I turned and looked. I couldn't see anything. And Ed and Lorraine, I glanced over at them, and they acted like there was nothing going on. They didn't, if they did sense something, they weren't letting on that they did. Anyway, she was terrified for a few minutes, and then finally she relaxed her grip upon my arm, and everything kind of calmed down. And Ed and Lorraine just kind of shrugged, and we went on with the interview. And there was a gentleman sitting across the table from me, and I noticed that what looked like a drop fell in front of him and splattered on the table. And he leaped up, and he said, "That's enough of that. This is about the fifth time this has happened." And he went over to the other side of the table, refusing to sit there any longer. So, curiously, I got up on a chair, and I searched the entire area above our table looking for a leak, a damp spot. Rob, I couldn't find anything. That place was dry as a bone. And to this day, I cannot explain what those drops were, nor can I explain what it was, that unseen thing standing in the doorway. I had kind of a theory. I can't explain it in greater detail, but is it possible, Rob, that Ed and Lorraine, who did claim to be possessed and sometimes followed by evil spirits because they had been to so many haunted sightings and scenes, is it possible that somehow inadvertently attached to them was this entity, this unseen thing that stood in the doorway?
Well, according to several of the guests that we've had here on the show, the answer would be yes.
Well, that's what I sensed, yeah, when it was all over with. And
what?
Ed and Lorraine, I guess you know Ed has since passed away.
Yes, I do, yeah.
He's gone now. And I did see Lorraine a couple of years ago when they brought out the remake of Amityville.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I suppose you've interviewed them over the years?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, did they ever tell you the story of the time they were in a car? They were in Connecticut on Interstate 84. And... they were driving along, and they passed an exit sign that read Promised Land, and Ed made a joke about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they came to another turnoff that was marked Lord's Valley. And no sooner had they passed that turnoff, suddenly the car, according to Lorraine, because Ed was not there to tell me the story, suddenly the car went out of control inexplicably, and according to Lorraine, Ed had always been an excellent driver, but he couldn't control the steering wheel. It just seemed to be totally out of control, crashed through a guardrail, plunged down a 40-foot embankment, and according to Lorraine, she said, "I prayed to God I could see rocks below, and if we hit those rocks, I knew the car would explode and we'd all burn up. But she says that suddenly the car suddenly rolled off, veered off a little bit, and came to a stop and didn't hit the rocks, didn't explode. Mm-hmm. And they both sat in the front seat, totally shaken, but alive, unharmed. And according to Lorraine, Ed turned to her, utterly shaken, and said, "Honey, even the Amityville Horror couldn't get us."
Tell me, after talking to Ed and Lorraine, what was your take on the Amityville Horror? I've got my doubts about its authenticity.
There's been so many books written about it. I think some books have totally debunked what happened there. And, I guess it's credibility. It boils down to who do you want to believe. And they certainly were a sweet couple. There was something disarming about the couple when you saw them in person. Mm-hmm. They didn't act special or different. They just seemed to be a happily married couple. They smiled at each other and held hands, had their arms around each other, and just reacted in a very, very normal way. I even had them over to the house one time for cocktails, and it was like having your next-door neighbors or your old friends come in and have a drink with you. There was nothing out of the ordinary. They seemed just to be commonplace people. So I put a lot of stock in what Lorraine has told me over the years.
What was it like with Christopher Lee?
Christopher Lee was a snob, let's face it. He comes from British royalty. He's a wonderful actor. But I have to tell you what happened. I had invited him to be a guest on the show. Uh-huh. This is 1979. I had just started the show a few months before that, and they were building me a new set. And so I was doing some comedy with that idea. I had brought in some members of a Star Wars fan club, and they mm-hmm. were dressed as the characters from Star Wars.
Right.
And they were carrying lumber and hammers and saws, and they were milling around as if they were building me a new set, because mm-hmm. the next week I was going to introduce my new dungeon set. Well, Christopher Lee arrived late. Normally guests arrived in time to brief them and explain what was happening. He walked in, he saw all this nonsense going on, this shtick, and he turned to my wife and Erica and said, "I believe this really isn't the kind of thing I want to be associated with." And he turned to leave, and he walked over to the exit door of the studio, but right above the door was a TV set, a monitor, and I was over on the other side of the studio doing my introduction. I was right in the middle of presenting the material that opened the show, and I was right at that moment where, "And now, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce you to my favorite fantasy writer, a man who inspired me when I was 10 years old, a man I consider the finest science fiction fantasy writer in America today, Ray Bradbury." And Ray Bradbury's, the footage ran, you know, they started the film rolling, the interview, and suddenly there was Ray Bradbury, and Christopher Lee froze. He stopped right at the door, and Ray Bradbury started delivering some of his beautifully poetic material, and Christopher, who knew Ray, paused to watch and listen, and 5 minutes later, the lights came on. I finished my sequence, and he turned to my wife and said, "Well, good enough for Ray Bradbury, good enough for me." And Christopher stayed. We did a wonderful interview. Mm-hmm. I think we did 15 or 20 minutes. I was able to scatter that material out over the next few weeks.
Excellent. But, John Stanley, stand by. You and I have to take a commercial break with the news at the bottom of the hour. When we return, ExoNation, more with our special guest this hour, John Stanley, www.stanleybooks.com. Still to come on tonight's show, T.K.C. Brennan, Cal Korf, and Henry May. My name's Rob McConnell. This is the ExoN, live and around the world from our studios in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, exclusively on Talkstar.
Welcome to the X Zone, a place where fact is fiction and fiction is reality. Now, here's your host, Rob McConnell.
Mm-hmm. John Stanley is our special guest. His website is www.stanleybooks.com. First of all, John, thanks very much for joining us tonight. It's great having you with us. Where did your interest in horror, science fiction, and the strange and bizarre come from?
It started when I was around 10 years old. It's still a very vivid memory. That's the year 1950 that I discovered pulp magazines.
Mm-hmm.
You remember those 25-cent
I sure do.
Things that used to be on the newsstands?
Yeah.
And I discovered a writer named Ray Bradbury.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
And I went through a change. I suddenly felt different about myself. And later, years later, when I actually met Ray Bradbury, I was interviewing him for the Chronicle, and eventually he would be a guest on Creature Features a number of times. I told him about this change I'd been through, and he says, oh, I know what you're talking about. I awakened your sense of wonder. And I said, could you explain that? And he says, yes. We're all born with a sleeping child within us, and as we discover the wonderful things about life, as we discover food and good music and our love for movies and reading and the opposite sex, different parts of that sleeping child are awakened, and when it's fully awakened, it becomes our sense of wonder. It's what drives us through life. Just do one thing, John, he said, promise me you will never let your sense of wonder fall asleep. Well, that was the first thing that began to awaken it. I also discovered movies in a new genre. I was a moviegoer from the time I was 6 years old, but if we look at the history of films during the 1940s, we realize that the horror film and the science fiction movies really were not popular genres then. It wasn't until the coming of the UFO phenomenon in, what was that, around 1947, I believe.
Yeah, about that.
Hollywood began making films, and there were two films that year. One was called The Thing from Another World.
Oh, heavens, yeah.
Movie.
Yeah.
Remember, the guys are trapped at the polar ice station with the alien that they've taken out of the crashed UFO.
That's right, yeah.
And it's stalking them. It's actually, it turned out to be Marshal Matt Dillon.
James Arness, yes.
I believe almost 7 feet tall, so he got the part of the creature. But it frightened me to death, and about 2 months later, I saw another film that frightened me to death, and that was called The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Oh, my
Remember
gosh.
Remember Gort the Robot?
That's right, with
when
Michael Rennie.
Patricia Neal mm-hmm. Into this flying saucer, I was utterly petrified. And that's where it all started for me, and from then on, I couldn't get enough of it.
Michael Rennie did a fantastic job in that
film. Oh, yes, as the envoy from another planet coming to warn us,
yeah.
we better straighten up and fly right, or we're going to be in deep doo-doo, and it looks like
we're in the deep doo-doo
this again, I think.
Yeah. Why do you think so many people today are looking to the skies for answers to the problems here on this planet?
You know, that is a great, great question, and I'd like to relate that to the reality of what I did. You know, when I was a newspaper man, I realized that there was a character that I was creating within me,
mm-hmm.
One who was fascinated with almost all phases of the entertainment world. I was fascinated with how films were made. I would eventually become a filmmaker in limited ways myself. I was fascinated with film music. How did composers
mm-hmm.
Come up with these wonderful sounds that so carried me into the movies? The cinematographers, the writers, the directors, they all just intrigued me to a great deal. And when I got to the Creature Feature Show, Rob, a new kind of character began to come out of that. I had to find, you know, you can't just sit in front of a camera and talk to an audience. You have to have a point of view. And I decided that my point of view, since I was a horror host who did not dress up in a costume, I had my own sense of humor, yes, but I was not like the other horror hosts, that I still needed a character, and I realized that that character I had been as a newspaper man, inquiring with great curiosity with all the folks I met, I should do the same, only now it can now be on two different levels. It can be a fascination with our media, our movies and television, as they deal with the unseen world around us in a fictional way, vampires, werewolves, aliens from other planets, UFOs. On the other hand, there's also that unseen world around us that we all talk about, we're fascinated by it, and yet we can never prove it. Do ghosts really exist? Are people really abducted by aliens? Are we really seeing ships from another world when those things fly over our heads? I decided I will be the investigator. I will be the curious one, and I will let my guest be the UFO expert. I will let my guest be the one who wears the vampire costume, the werewolf costume. I will let my guest be the people who make some of our great movies, you know, the director of Alien, Ridley Scott, George Lucas, all of those wonderful folks. That's where it all started, and that's how I've carried that. I still carry that to this day. I'm an Elder Hostel teacher. Elder Hostel, are you familiar with that group? It's seniors. Seniors gather from all over America. They come here to the Bay Area.
No, I'm not.
I face 50 of them at a time, and it's a challenge, of course. They're all over 55, so you got to keep them awake. You know, that's the first challenge. But I try to entertain them with my knowledge about the entertainment world, and also classes. I present classes on Frank Sinatra, Louis Armstrong, Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, a lot of the folks that I met firsthand, and I can talk about them firsthand.
Who was the strangest guest you ever interviewed on your show?
Whoa, boy, that's a great question. Certainly one of the strangest producers that I ever met was Irwin Allen. Irwin Allen was one of the most successful television producers of the 1960s. You might recall Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea.
Yes, I do. Richard Basehart.
How about Lost in Space? That was his big ratings hit.
Yeah.
And he did others, too, Time Tunnel and so on, and I think Land of the Giants. I came along before his movie career started with The Poseidon Adventure.
Mm-hmm.
He started making disaster films that were very popular. And I wanted to talk to him about science fiction, and I had a lot of questions when I met him at 20th Century Fox. And he had a giant office and a huge desk that he sat behind. And I had very serious questions about it. I was about science fiction and fantasy and the movies and so on, and his perception of all of these things. And for some reason, he didn't really want to get into depth about that. And he was offended by my questions, and after about 20 minutes, he asked me to leave his office. That had never happened before. To this day, I wonder what was really troubling that man. What was his problem that he couldn't really deal with a fantasy and science fiction? Some of my associates back at the paper said, well, the man's never produced a serious thing in his life. You know, these are all just juvenile science fiction shows, mainly for children, you know. And you were coming along and wanted to discuss science fiction like an adult. And he wasn't quite ready for that. I don't know if that's quite the truth of what happened, but that's one interpretation. That would be certainly one of the strangest, to be asked to leave the office after you've hardly begun to scratch the surface.
All right, you're on air on your TV set.
A studio, yeah.
Yeah, your studio. What is the strangest thing that happened to you live on air?
Oh, boy, there were some guests who did walk out before the show would start. I don't know if anything really happened on air. Are you thinking of something I've written about and I can't think of it right now?
You know, because I've talked to many talk show hosts on television, and they always have these horror stories that a guest starts going one way, and they don't know which way the guest is going, and there are times, even on radio, where you say, oh, I hope they don't go that way with this question.
I didn't really have that problem. I did have some techniques for interviewing celebrities and people that I've never met before. Mm-hmm. I always researched as deeply as I could. I tried to know some little-known facts about somebody. It's wonderful if you can sit down with somebody and just mention, say, I saw an old film of yours you made 20 or 30 years ago, a film that nobody else would remember today. And, oh, you know about that? Oh, well, that opened up the door because then they trusted you. Well, yep. If he knows that about me, he really cares, you know, about my career and what I've been doing. And people would open up. And I always found, in most cases, people were more than willing to discuss wherever I wanted to take them.
Tell me, why should we love Lucy?
Oh, boy. I'm glad you asked, Rob. There is a reason, and few people know this. Everybody remembers I Love Lucy, and Lucille Ball is one of our great television stars, and she was. She and Desi really innovated the industry in more ways than one. In 1957, she and Desi bought a studio called RKO Radio Pictures, and they turned it into a television factory for the next 10 years called Desilu Productions. Well, they divorced in 1960, and 1 year later, Lucy went to the studio one day to discover that she was the head of the board of directors. She now ran a studio, the very studio that she had been a contract player at back in the 1930s. In 1966, 1 year before she sold the studio, NBC called up and said, "We've seen the pilot for Star Trek. We think it's wonderful, and we want to book it for the fall lineup." So all of the technical and money advisors at the studio told Lucy, "No, don't do it. Don't greenlight Star Trek. Cancel Star Trek now before it's too late. Gene Roddenberry, the producer, is going crazy. He's spending money like a madman. He will bankrupt this studio." Well, Lucy listened to all of this and then said, "No, I'm not going to cancel Star Trek. We're going to greenlight it. It's going to go ahead." And one of the executives shook his head and said, "Lucy, have you lost your mind?" She said, "No, I was just thinking about that day back in, I believe it was 1939, when I came to this studio and they told me I was no longer needed. My contract had expired. And frankly, I didn't want to pass that feeling on to all of those wonderful people who are part of the cast and crew of Star Trek. I didn't have the heart to tell them no."
Wow.
And she told me this story in 1975, many years after it was all over. Jackie Gleason and Art Carney were there. She was getting ready to make some CBS comedy shows with those two actors. And that's why I was there. I was there to cover that. But I had to ask Lucy. I said, "Lucy, were you involved in Star Trek? Because you ran the studio." And she says, "I sure was." And what I guess the ultimate irony, Rob, is that Paramount bought the studio for $18 million.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe we could easily estimate that just from that one franchise alone, the Star Trek franchise, they have earned, billions of dollars?
Oh, yes, easily.
At least. That more than paid, yeah. That one asset more than paid back Paramount for buying up RKO. And that's the real reason we should love Lucy.
Now, how about the obsession of Leonard Nimoy, speaking about Star Trek?
Leonard Nimoy, I've always found him to be a fascinating individual, complex, not your ordinary laid-back actor. I first met Leonard in 1966. The show hadn't even come on the air yet. He was filming at Desilu, the city on the edge of forever, on the day we met, which turned out to be one of the great classic episodes. And Leonard was very worried. He had the pointed ears. He had the strange colored skin. And he said, I hope you don't report this inaccurately because this is going to be an adult science fiction show. He was very worried about Lost in Space and all the others setting a current trend, and everyone would assume that this new adventure in space, Star Trek, was going to be another Lost in Space, you know, designed for children. It is not. This is going to be for the adults. And he was right on the edge of, I've always felt that right at that time, Leonard was really on the edge of his career not going anywhere. He had been playing Indians and villains and so on in various episodes, and not too much was happening. But this was the one part that really was going to change his life forever and move him off into an incredible area of success. Leonard was obsessed by those, I guess they call them Trekkers or Trekkies.
Trekkies.
Trekkies. He came to the studio in 1980. The first motion picture had been released, and I had planned a complete two-hour show. I had all kinds of special material, interview material, and I was working to get ready. And that morning, his limousine pulled up to the front of the TV studio at Jack London Square in Oakland, and he saw a small crowd of fans out front, and he refused to get out of the car. He ordered the driver to go to the back. And he came in, and he said, unless I got rid of those people out there, he wasn't going to do the show. And I finally pinned him down, and he admitted that there was one woman out there who was a Trekkie, who'd been coming to see his play, Theo, which is the story of Vincent Van Gogh's brother.
Right.
He was doing a one-man show in San Francisco. And apparently she was sitting in the front row every night, staring up at him. And this had driven him to the brink, I guess, of couldn't stand it any longer. And so I had to go out, tell the small crowd, I'm sorry, we can't let you in the studio today.
John, let's continue this on the other side of the commercial break. John Stanley's our special guest, www.stanleybooks.com. And when we come back, we'll continue the story about the obsession with Leonard Nimoy. Don't go away, we'll be back in two. John Stanley is our special guest. His website is stanleybooks.com. First of all, John, thanks very much for joining us tonight, and I wish you nothing but the greatest of success. And
Rob, I appreciate that.
Any chance of you coming back on the air to do another TV series?
Well, I was a guest on Cinema Insomnia, which is a Bay Area show hosted by Mr. Lobo. He's one of the few surviving horror hosts of the day.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I'm pretty much retired. I want to continue to write some of my memoirs. In addition to another book, I'd love to do another follow-up to the I Was a Horror Host, because I hardly scratched the surface with all the material that I did have. I'd like to do a book on the golden age of Hollywood. I had the wonderful chance over those years to meet people like Jimmy Stewart and Mae West and Fred McMurray.
Wow.
And Lloyd Bridges and some of the great stars of that period. I'd love to put together another book in that vein.
Was Fred McMurray and Jimmy Stewart the gentleman that they appeared to be on the big screen?
Fred McMurray was such an ordinary kind of a guy. He didn't really think of himself as anybody special. In fact, he started to tell me that his he had had a leak down in the cellar. That seemed to be the most important thing in his life that day. So some, I guess the water furnace had broken open or something, and that was the topic of the day, the flooded cellar at his home. Jimmy Stewart, he loved to talk about, he didn't like to talk about the war. I tried to get him to talk about being a pilot, a bomber pilot in World War II. He wouldn't go near that, but he loved to talk about the characters in his movies. And he told that story of how he really had to redefine himself after World War II, because It's a Wonderful Life was a failure. Everything he was doing wasn't working until he took a Western role. And then when he started playing cowboy characters, his career turned around.
Jeez, I can't believe that he actually thought that What a Wonderful Life was a failure.
Oh, it was. It was a box office disaster.
And yet now it's
It almost destroyed the career of Frank Capra. And what happened, Frank Capra forgot to renew the copyright. The film, 26 years later, went into public domain, and that's when suddenly everybody started running the film on television, because they didn't have to pay any royalties.
Right.
And that's the new generation, and the old generation suddenly discovered this movie that everybody had ignored in 1947, was a classic, and it's, of course, today considered, you know, one of the best films from the 1940s.
Well, I'll tell you something. We have it here in our home on DVD now, and we watch it every Christmas Eve.
Yeah, it's an annual event.
It's a tradition.
You really should see it once a year.
John, we have to say so long for now, but I would love to have the opportunity of having you back on so we can continue discussing the Golden Age.
I would love to, and could I correct just one thing?
Please.
It's stanleybooks.net.
Stanleybooks.net.
Yeah. Otherwise, everything has been great tonight. I've really enjoyed it.
It's great having you with us, and thanks for sharing your time.
Okay, and keep creepy Canada creepy, would you please? And I'll do my best to keep San Francisco creepy in my own special way.
You got a deal there, friend.
Okay.
John Stanley, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
www.stanleybooks.net. Now, when we come back from the news at the top of the hour, we're going to be speaking with T. Casey Brennan. Now, at one time, he claimed to have been the trigger man of the JFK assassinations. He's a comic book artist and creator. He's the most vocal victim of MKUltra, mind control by the CIA, and he's homeless. Let's find out what's going on. Don't go away.